Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you another episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. The podcast examines pivotal moments in legislation related to hate, prejudice, and the fight for equal rights in Delaware. In this fifth episode, we focus on paid family and medical leave legislation passed and signed in Delaware in 2022. It makes providing leave of up to 12 weeks mandatory for most businesses with 10 or more employees. State Senator Sarah McBride was the prime sponsor of the bill and a driving force in getting it passed. McBride joins this episode to discuss the law, the work to pass it, and its anticipated impact. So let's start with a quick overview for those who may not be completely familiar with the Delaware paid leave law. Can you give us kind of a brief sketch of what it will provide when it gets up and running?
Sure. The Delaware Paid Family and Medical Leave Program, which was established through the Healthy Delaware Families Act passed by the Delaware General Assembly in 2022, will provide up to 12 weeks of wage replacement for Delaware workers who are out on leave to welcome a child into their family, to struggle through a serious illness, to take care of a family member struggling through a serious illness, or to adjust to the deployment or return from deployment of a family member in the military. This is a critical social safety net program that the overwhelming majority, essentially every other developed nation, has established, and now 10 other states plus Delaware have adopted within their own legislative process. I'm really excited as the program builds out. It'll start providing benefits to eligible Delaware workers in 2026. But this is the single largest expansion of the social safety net in modern Delaware history, and it'll provide that little bit of peace of mind through this insurance program for Delaware workers as they face the inevitable challenges and hardships of life, from joys to the fear of an illness.
Let's kind of work our way to how we got here. And I guess where I'll start is with the state itself, which dipped its toes in this area when it offered a version of paid leave for state workers in 2018. How important do you feel that was in providing a sense of what paid leave looks like, how it works, and perhaps laying the groundwork for expanding it out to the entire population?
Sure. Well, there's different types of leave, and there's different qualifying events. The state of Delaware for years has provided what essentially we often refer to as short-term disability or short-term medical leave to their workers. Then in 2019, to your question, the state expanded their leave policy to include parental leave, up to 12 weeks of parental leave for state employees. But of course, we know that state employees are just a fraction of the overall workforce in Delaware. And unfortunately, the private sector was continuing to lag behind when it came to providing these life-saving benefits to their own employees. Some of that was just because there was not an interest by some employers to provide this benefit. For some, it was also, it just was not economical to provide this benefit on their own. That's why this type of policy that we've established through the Healthy Delaware Families Act helps to actually make this benefit more affordable and accessible, not just for workers, but for the employers who otherwise might struggle to afford it on their own. But it was an important step when the state provided parental leave benefits to their employees. It led by example. It demonstrated that these are benefits that are in demand, that an increasingly competitive employee market demands employers provide these types of benefits. And so it certainly laid the foundation among the General Assembly and among, I think, the larger economy, that these are benefits that if you want to compete, you should and you really must provide.
Following up on that, before introducing the bill, you held a series of roundtables to discuss the concept with the public up and down the state. How did they help inform the bill that you wound up introducing, and how much influence do you think it had in garnering some of the initial support the bill needed, particularly from several business interests, including the state chamber, which a lot of times were opposed to even considering something like this?
Sure. Well, the bill was a multi-stage process. A bill this large requires conversation. I introduced the original version of the Healthy Delaware Families Act in May of 2021 with a coalition of around 40 organizations that were in support from labor unions to healthcare advocacy groups to faith communities. But the next year was that iterative process where we held those town halls that you referenced. And in addition to those town halls with mostly supporters, I also held roughly 200 hours of meetings with stakeholders on all sides of the issue, people who agreed with me, and frankly, just as importantly, people who disagreed. I met with chambers up and down the state, local chambers, county chambers, and of course, as you mentioned, the state chamber of commerce. And through that statewide dialogue, I made a series of compromises. Now, I have always said that I believe that the original version of Senate Bill 1 of the Healthy Delaware Families Act was the gold standard, was the best policy we could have adopted. But governing requires compromise. And for legislation like this, which requires through the state constitution a supermajority in the Delaware General Assembly, I believed it was important to attempt to build as broad of a coalition as possible to guarantee that we could move this legislation and frankly move it as quickly as possible since this benefit was long overdue. And so during that process, I made several compromises, introduced what we call a substitute version of the legislation. And as you alluded to in your question, that final version of the legislation resulted in a coalition that wasn't just those 40 to 50 organizations that supported the bill at the start. It also added the State Chamber of Commerce and ultimately was able to achieve a bipartisan supermajority in the Delaware General Assembly.
Was there one or two of those compromises you felt were particularly crucial to getting that supermajority coalition pulled together?
Sure. So there were two elements, I think, of the changes that were particularly relevant. One was that instead of having this program automatically apply to businesses of all sizes, something I still believe is right and something that the 10 other states that have adopted this have done, we did not automatically include a certain number of small businesses. Small businesses under 10 employees for parental leave and small businesses under 25 employees for medical or family caregiving leave. That change, I think, was a major factor in securing business support for the legislation. Similarly, many of these employers of 50 employees or above, were already used to working under the federal FMLA law, which ensures that workers are able to access up to 12 weeks of job-protected unpaid leave for those qualifying events I mentioned at the start. Those employers had gotten used to those rules and those regulations. And so we tied many of the eligibility criteria, many of the regulations that would be promulgated under the law to the federal FMLA to ensure that there was consistency between federal and state rules.
Was that the biggest concern you ran into in terms of opposition? Was the impact on specifically small businesses, particularly coming out of the pandemic at a time when there were strong inflation worries? Was that maybe the biggest angst you saw from those who are opposing this bill?
Sure. I think there was concern around the impact on the small business community. Now, let's be clear. A lot of small businesses supported the original version of the legislation, including, for instance, Brouhaha, which understood immediately. Elisa Merkitis, the founder and CEO at the time of Brouhaha, understood immediately these benefits are in demand. And the most cost-effective way for a smaller business to provide this benefit is through the public option state insurance program, which the legislation creates. But there were some stakeholder groups, some business associations who had concerns. And so we did make those changes at their behest. They wanted a larger exemption. We landed on 10 and 25. But what I will say is, we have the benefit of not being the first state to do this, which means we know what the experience is in other states. And in the states that have adopted similar policies that apply to businesses of all size, in the largest state, for instance, that has this, the state with the benefit the longest as well, 90% of employers say that their paid family and medical leave program had either no impact on their business's bottom line or a positive impact on their bottom line. And small businesses were even more likely than larger businesses to say that the program had a positive, not just neutral, impact on their bottom line. In Jersey, 66% of small businesses said that the paid family and medical leave was a boon for their small business, was incredibly helpful, and that they had very positive views of the program. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, because paid family and medical leave laws like this, they don't create life events. People have life events and inevitably have to take time off work for those life events. And for a smaller business that doesn't already have these types of private insurance programs, because frankly, they can't afford it at the rate that the private marketplace offers it at. For a small business, let's say you're 30 employees, let's say you're 20 employees. An employee comes to you as a small business owner, and we always hear, rightfully, small businesses are like family. They come to you and they say, I have cancer. I have to undergo chemotherapy and radiation for 4 weeks. Unless you're lacking in compassion, that small business owner will say, well, of course, you have to take time off, even though I'm not at that point legally obligated because I'm under that FMLA federal limit. But of course, you need to take this time off. And of course, you're going to need to pay your rent or your mortgage or put food on the table. So I'm going to continue to pay you your salary. Well, under this paid family and medical leave program funded through a fraction of a percentage payroll contribution split between the employee and the employer, rather than that unpredictable cost that they can't factor in at the beginning of the year when they're making their budgets, but they feel compelled to do, and they still have to pay that employee's wage out in some portion, if not it's an entirety, because they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart. Now they have this predictable minimal cost for the payroll contribution. And then ultimately, when that employee is out on leave for any of those qualifying events, instead of feeling a need to continue to pay that employee's salary, the employee goes onto the insurance program, which provides partial wage replacement, and the employer is then able to retain that wage, either something they save or utilize that retained wage to hire a replacement temporarily, to pay overtime for someone else who has to fill that role. Ultimately, it all either comes out in a wash or, again, even if it comes out in a wash, because of that greater predictability of cost is a benefit for the small business. And so I have never, ever doubted that the original version was great for small businesses, great for big businesses, great for employees. But ultimately, you know, we don't get all that we want in the legislative process. And, you know, we can always come back and have a conversation at a later date around, you know, restoring elements of the original law. But the version that passed had to include that, I believed, in order to get the support necessary, and that a big step forward, even if it's not everything we want, is an important step.
Senator McBride, this podcast is focused on efforts to combat prejudice and fight for equal rights. And I suppose some might not immediately see how paid leave fits. How do you see it connecting with this overarching theme of equity and equality for Delawareans?
Sure. First off, we have to separate the false distinction in our policies and our politics that separates issues into economic issues and social issues. You cannot have equality for all if you have an economy that only works for the few. But you also can't have an economy that works for everyone if even one person is kept out of a job because of prejudice or discrimination. So all of these issues are inextricably linked. But when it comes to paid family and medical leave, a couple of things I would say. The first is that we used to lead the world in women's workforce participation. But over the last three decades, as the rest of the world has caught up in what we call our care infrastructure, including with policies like paid family and medical leave that allow people for whom caregiving responsibilities disproportionately fall, that allow those individuals to stay in the workforce, over the last three decades, the rest of the world has surpassed us in women's workforce participation. And so when we're talking about gender parity, about gender equity in pay and in wages and in opportunity and in economic and financial security, you can't have that conversation if you don't also talk about issues like paid family and medical leave. One of the greatest contributors to wage disparities between men and women is women leaving the workforce at the prime of their careers because we don't have the policies that allow, again, those for whom caregiving responsibilities fairly or unfairly disproportionately fall on, that we don't have the policies and the infrastructure in place to guarantee that people don't have to choose between their family and their job. And so this is a critical part of that infrastructure to provide people of every gender the fair opportunity to start a family, to fulfill their responsibilities to themselves and their loved ones while also pursuing their dreams and their passions and, heck, just getting the paycheck that they need to survive. Secondly, and relatedly, We know that because caregiving responsibilities disproportionately fall on women in our society, that means that often people are pushed out of their job. They face discrimination or unfair treatment by their employer because they choose to fulfill their personal responsibilities to themselves or their family members, which means that workplace discrimination under the sort of umbrella of an individual taking leave disproportionately impacts women. And then finally, what I would say is we know that the industries that disproportionately employ women, and in particular women of color, are the industries that disproportionately do not have these types of benefits. And so we increasingly see these benefits among white-collar employees, but we don't see them among blue-collar employees. We don't see them among individuals in the service industry. We don't see them for individuals who are often on the front lines of healthcare or education. And again, those are industries, those are sectors that are disproportionately women and disproportionately women of color. And so we have to have these types of policies to guarantee that there's equity around this benefit across our economy.
As we talk about these issues, we often talk about them in this larger kind of conceptual framework. One thing we've tried to do on this podcast is talk about it from a more personal level, noting that these concepts have very personal, real-life impact on people's daily lives. And I know throughout your work on this bill, you discussed how pay leave was a personal issue for you. How did your personal story help you in developing this bill and kind of articulating its importance to people on that personal level?
You know, I'm a big believer in the fundamental truth that the political is fundamentally personal. I didn't introduce this bill. I didn't champion this bill. I didn't pass this bill solely because of my own experiences. It truly was rooted in the issues that I was hearing on the doors. Parents struggling with a new child, parents who went back to work days after giving birth, adult workers who were struggling to care for an aging parent. I was hearing this time and time again, even before COVID, when I was knocking on doors in my state Senate campaign. And I truly believe, before I get to my own personal motivation, that one of Delaware's most significant medium to long-term challenges is that we don't have enough young workers in this state. We aren't keeping them and we aren't attracting them, particularly as we're seeing population growth disproportionately among retirees. We need to make sure that we're meeting that growth with support and opportunity for young workers so that we have the workforce and the tax base necessary to support the retirees who we are welcoming into our state, to support everyone who's coming into our state, to attract businesses, to guarantee that they know that they have the workforce necessary if they locate here. And the only way to do that is to bring more young people to Delaware and to keep more young people in Delaware. And this benefit, we know, is a critical part of that decision-making process for young workers who are on the verge of starting a family about where they're going to live and where they're going to work. So I will just say all of that, but it is absolutely personal for me. As I mentioned earlier on, part of my passion for this legislation was rooted in my own experience as a caregiver myself to the person who would become my husband, Andy, during his battle with cancer. I met Andy when I was still in college, and he was the smartest and kindest and most importantly, goofiest person I had ever met. That's a critical quality in a partner for me. They have to be goofy. And I fell in love with him really quickly. About a year, a little more than a year into our relationship, Andy was diagnosed with cancer, oral cancer. And for anyone who's ever been diagnosed with cancer or who's had a loved one diagnosed with cancer, you know it is like a punch in the gut unlike anything you've ever experienced. But even from the first moments after hearing that word and getting that diagnosis, Andy and I both knew how lucky he and we were. He was lucky to have health insurance that would allow him to get care that would hopefully save his life. And I was lucky, and he was lucky as well, to have flexibility with our employers that allowed him the time and ability to get care that would hopefully save his life, and me to have the time and ability to be there by his side to care for him, to suction his tracheostomy tube and tend to his wounds after a 12-hour surgery that left him having to relearn how to talk. To be there through 6 weeks of radiation and chemotherapy that left him challenged to breathe. And that flexibility also allowed me to be there by his side when he found out that his cancer was terminal, to love him and to marry him and eventually to walk him to his passing. And up until his last breath, Andy knew how lucky he was. I know how lucky I was. And I ran for the state Senate. I serve in public office because at the end of the day, I do not believe that in the most developed and the wealthiest nation on earth, that time and that ability to get care, that little bit of breathing room through the inevitable challenges of life, I don't believe that should be a matter of luck. I believe it should be the law of the land. And so it was a deep passion of mine rooted in my experience. And you know, after the Healthy Delaware Families Act passed, a member of the staff came up to me. And they had heard me talk about Andy on the floor a little bit and in some of the roundtables. But they had just also read my book. And in that book, I recount my experiences with Andy. And the staffer said to me, "I didn't realize until finishing your book how much of this was a love letter to Andy." And in many ways it was. He was someone who not only lost his life in a way that reinforced the right to healthcare and all that that means and all that contributes to being able to access healthcare, but he also lived his life in pursuit of that principle. His life was spent expanding access to healthcare for people. That was his job. And so I was proud to do this because of what it will do for Delaware workers now and for generations to come. I was proud to do this because of the impact on families and how it will strengthen families and strengthen our economy and strengthen employers. I was proud to do this because I know it met the needs of a lot of neighbors that I was talking to, but I was also proud to do it for Andy and to write in the laws of Delaware in many ways this love letter to him.
We appreciate you sharing that story. And obviously it's a story that we all know plays out for so many other people on a daily basis, which is what makes getting this up and running so important. And that is a process that is still in progress with, as you, I think you mentioned earlier, the official start date for people to start accessing these benefits in January of 2026. Do you have a sense of how that implementation process is going and what plans are in place to make people aware that this is a benefit that they will now have?
Sure. So the Department of Labor is tasked with implementing and executing this law, and they are currently in the process of staffing out, of onboarding the technology to make this a seamless program and a seamless process for employees and employers alike. They've put forward regulations to flesh out legislation. You know, legislation, when you write legislation, it's a sort of a 35,000-foot view of the program and the challenges it's seeking to address. And the regulations are where they make policy porous and make sure that it's digestible in individual circumstances so that there's clarity in the nuances and the gray that inevitably arises and can't be fully captured in a bill. And so they've been doing that. And throughout all of this, engaging with the business community, making sure that the business community, the employer community, is aware of their responsibilities and their rights under this program. And through it, making sure that they're educating employees as well. And so there's been an ongoing statewide conversation. Similarly, as is always the case, I mean, I have a job as a legislator because legislation can always be improved upon. And there have certainly been some tweaks and adjustments that we've been working on with the Department of Labor and employees and employers to make sure that the program continues to reach its fullest potential. And so I think it's going well. But it's certainly a long process. And I am confident that by January 2025, when the contributions begin, and of course, January 2026, when access to the benefit begins, that we will have a fully operational program that, of course, will always have room for improvements. but will be providing efficiently and effectively this life-saving benefit for thousands of Delaware workers.
You mentioned earlier Delaware became the 10th state plus the District of Columbia to put this type of benefit in place, and there are other states that appear to be moving in that direction as well at this point. Are you optimistic it will continue to grow state by state, or since you are running for Congress, there's a chance perhaps some national version of this will eventually happen?
Absolutely, we're going to continue to see progress in state legislatures. I think after we passed it, after the 2022 election, I believe Minnesota may have passed a law, and other states are potentially going to do so. Pennsylvania, there's a lot of momentum despite divided government, which I think gives a blueprint and hope for ultimately a federal solution here. Because at the end of the day, most of the time on issues of this scale, while you're going to have a critical mass of states adopting it, not every state will. And the only way to guarantee that there is a truly universal national benefit and that the rules are consistent across state lines, which I think is an important goal as well for the employer community, ultimately, we deserve and we need federal action. We need a federal paid family and medical leave program. And frankly, through a federal paid family and medical leave program, we can eliminate that payroll contribution that we have within the state programs, because the federal government, as was proposed under the Build Back Better Act, can simply fund the program itself. It's not a particularly expensive program in relative terms at the federal level. And we certainly can afford to do it, especially with the proposals that President Biden had put forward in 2021 and 2022. So I would like to see us build on the progress that we've made here in Delaware and in a number of other states and provide a universal nationwide benefit.
You've been listening to the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware, with State Senator Sarah McBride discussing Delaware's paid family and medical leave law. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. The podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Delaware Humanities is the recipient of United We Stand Connecting Through Culture funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities to support A More Just Delaware and related programming. And stay with us. We meet the new director of the George Reed House and Gardens in the latest edition of History Matters. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media.